Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, with all this heavy weather out there, it makes getting to meetings almost close to impossible. Yeah, even down here in Florida, we have some cold snaps and we have some heavy rain. And from time to time, listen, not everybody lives in this wonderful weather that we have usually. But, you know, listen, even northern Florida is getting some snow. And if you're in the Midwest and in the upper Northeast, well, yeah, I don't have to say anything about that. So you know what? Skip the next flight. Skip the drive. Use GoToMeeting.com to host an online meeting instead. Everyone just simply logs on to GoToMeeting.com and they can see your computer desktop on their screen. With just a click, you can host just any kind of presentation and training sessions or product demos right from your computers. That's what's really cool about it. We do that often and we have online sessions with clients and we talk with different people in our industry and we want to share things. Well, we use GoToMeeting. And the nice thing is that you can try GoToMeeting free for 30 days, but you must visit GoToMeeting.com/podcast. That's GoToMeeting.com/podcast for a free 30-day trial. Well, howdy. Andrew Horowitz here. This is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It is episode number 144, and I'm going to talk to you about a couple of things coming up that I need your participation in. We have a big number coming up, episode number 150, and I'll talk to you about that in 1 second. But today's show is going to be action-packed. We're going to get right to it very early because first on, we have from an interview I did with him on Friday, John Najarian, who is from Options Monster, and he is actually going to come to us live from from the NASDAQ market site where he just did a report midday and talking about what's going on in the options market with regard to the options expiration and the massive volume and the difficulty the markets had that day, some outlook and some opinion from him. We also have a very special opportunity that I'm going to call in, and that's going to be to John Markman, a good friend of mine, a gentleman who is just incredibly detailed when it comes to the market, comes to research, and he's going to talk to us hopefully about some of his market outlook as well. But I want to talk to him about his new book that he has out, Reminiscence of a Stock Operator by Jesse Livermore. He did a job at annotating that and coming up with a lot of the details and the insight and the things that really weren't discussed in the book. And it's really quite the read. And I'm going to give a buzz to him, bring him on. After we listened to that interview that I did with John Najarian, I wanted to mention to you that episode number 150 is coming up very soon, and it's kind of special. We've been doing this for, close to 3 years or more right now. Really quite incredible. Thank you so much for being there. Thank you so much for listening and telling your friends about it. By the way, if you want to, just make sure to tell your friends. You can go right to iTunes. There's a little button on there that says mail this to a friend or email this to a friend. Let's get this audience really rocking and making sure that everybody is becoming disciplined in their investment approach. But what I wanted to do for episode 150 is something special. I wanted to do a listener show. I want your questions, your concerns, your thoughts, your fears. We can talk about that. So what you can do is simply just go to the Disciplined Investor, and that's disciplinedinvestor.com, of course, and in the show notes for this show and the next couple of shows, we're going to have a link where you could just simply put your information and just email us. If you want to participate, we'll do a call-in, we'll do a session. I'll talk to you about your portfolio, your stocks, your planning, whatever you want to talk about, and we'll be glad to do so. Everybody that participates will get a free copy of my book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. So make sure if you want to do that, because it's only going to be a few people that we could fit into one show, but we're going to do that for show number 150. It's the listener call-in show, and we've done that before. It was very successful. So make sure to head over there right now and do that, because I'm telling you, space is going to run out very quickly. So I want to make sure you do that. Okay? So before we get to the show with John Najarian, which will be in a minute, I want to talk to you about what's going on. Well, we saw a couple of interesting things happened last week, didn't we? We saw three majors come out with the opening of the earnings season. First, we saw Alcoa And we saw Intel and JP Morgan. Now, Alcoa came out. They gave earnings, which was an absolute, just a horrible, horrible looking earnings. Expectations were high for 6 cents per share. Came in at 1 cent. Yeah, they did beat on the revenue expectation and they saw a rise in their revenue. But the concern comes in, why did they have such a wide miss? They said it was due to currency transactions as well as the increased cost of the materials that went into the processing. Now, with that in mind, the currency numbers, well, put that aside for 1 second. Could have done a better job at currency management and blaming some of the dollar's moves recently. But more importantly, what's happening with the higher cost of materials and food? We've been concerned about that, that we're going to see some kind of a drag on earnings for the companies that have the highest requirements for that in what we call our inventory restocking cycle. We've seen a lot of the materials come up from a very, very low point, gave a great supercharge to many companies. But now that is kind of starting to look a little bit concerning. Add to the fact that if we do see a rise in the jobs numbers, aside from the 1.2 million people that will be employed by the census, so we're going to start seeing that in the next few months in the jobs numbers. If we do start seeing a rise in the hiring coming back, how is that going to affect the bottom lines if that was the biggest catalyst to driving earnings in the last number of quarters? How much is that going to drag down? Will the analyst be right? Will the analyst, as usual, be wrong and be, you know, very, very optimistic on their numbers? I think that's something we need to look at. In our latest edition of the Economic Commentary and Review that we put out for our clients at Horowitz & Company, side note, little note, if you want to become a client, you can do so. Great time to do so. Never been better. $50,000 minimum for the Discipline Investor Managed Growth Strategy, and you can check it out going to the website. There's a little button there that says, check out the 14-minute virtual tour, which we're still in the process of updating that, but you'll get a good idea and a flavor for what we do. Never before, I'm telling you right now, never before have you seen transparency like we do it. Because what we do is we put out a weekly discussion for our clients, a daily discussion that talks about what we're buying, why we're buying it, what we sold, the good, the bad, all the things that happen in there to give you some, you know, advice. Also, you're going to get some trading, you'll get some swing trading, you get all sorts of really cool things. So if you've kind of been saying, hey, I'm not sure what I want to do with my investments, should I stay long, should I go short, I don't know what to do, I'm just sitting here, I'm paralyzed, whatever it is, check it out. All right, put that aside. But we put out this whole discussion of, you know, are we going to see the square root recovery, kind of where we've seen a peak right now and a flattening moving forward? And if so, is this inventory restocking cycle reached a peak where now what we're going to see is increasing inventories and lack of buying? We saw the increase of inventories last week. Question is that because of a lack of buying by the end users, or is that because the there's a lot of orders coming in? That's what we have to be watching for. In addition to that, we saw Intel come out with numbers that beat handily, looked really good, but the stock came down. JP Morgan first came out with the headline that they beat as well, disappointing on their earnings. We saw their delinquency rates coming down a little bit, but their loan provisions were increasing and their bad loans and the souring loans were starting to increase as well. So there's some kind of push and pull going on in this market right now. And I think that the three that came out were very disappointing overall. And it could be that because analysts are ahead of themselves and the stock market has a little bit of froth in it right now. So we took a defensive posture last week. We actually went short oil, and that has paid off handsomely. Oil was down 6% last week. Really, really got battered. And we think that that's going to be a continuing trend. There'll be some kind of a choppiness right there. But we did go short oil, and we shortened up our portfolio into last week. If you were reading the disciplineinvestor.com, you would have noticed that on Mondays we put indicators that we're watching. And we highlighted and said, you know, getting ready with hedges, because we saw a lot of overbought situations in the market. And, you know, that overbought situation oftentimes, as high as it was, by the way, I only saw a few times in the last year. And that was in October was the main time when we saw that follow up of that November kind of move down. And then also saw that in June, where we saw the incredible move down of about 8% in about 3 weeks. For the markets. We also saw that China is pulling out their stimulus, or at least slowing it down, requiring banks to have a higher level of overall assets backing the loans. And China got a little spooked. As a matter of fact, China and Brazil are two markets that are down for the year, which is very interesting to look at. Hong Kong is flat. Japan is up about 7% year-to-date already. And the S&P 500 is, what, about 1.5% year-to-date. Only 2 weeks in, lots of news to digest. The whole thing in Haiti is horrible. But boy, did we see some natural disasters last week. Another one in Venezuela. We saw an earthquake there too. And then we saw on top of that some weird terrorist stuff going on, right? We saw that scare in the Texas nuclear plant. We saw something about a bomb on a plane that was rerouted. I mean, just kind of some crazy things going on in the world right now, and it kind of gives you just a moment to pause and say, what, you know, must be a full moon or something going on. But the Haiti thing is really, really an awful situation. And then on top of it, we saw a devaluation of the currency in Venezuela, which caused a lot of trouble. We'll see how that plays out for many of the multinational companies that do business in that area. So anyway, lots going on there. I wanted to kind of be a short opening here and then get right to our discussion because I think, you know, two guests takes up a good amount of time. So let's get right on with my recent discussion with a great options trader, great guy, good friend of mine, John Najarian. Let's listen to that, and then we'll come back and we'll give a call to John Markman. All right, it's now Friday, and it is options expiration, and it is one of those crazy days in the market, lots of volume, lots of activity, and I thought none better to bring on to talk to us about what's going on in the world of options and also market direction, but my very good friend, John Najarian, who is the co-founder with his maybe brother, is he your twin brother?
6 years apart, though, Andrew.
But still.
So, yes, he's a twin brother, which, you know, my mother unfortunately carried him for an extra 6 years.
Man, that, I got to tell you something. No wonder she's so bitter at him, huh?
Exactly.
But anyway, thanks for joining us. I thought it would be great to do it live. You're down the NASDAQ site. I know doing the halftime report at CNBC, and tonight you'll be doing the options report and the fast money on CNBC. So we've had a lot of volatility today or downside, but more so, of course, on options expiration day, the third Friday of the month, we see a lot of volume come in. So I thought we'd start out, maybe you can explain to people, what the heck is this options expiration all about, and what does it mean to them?
Absolutely. Well, every month on the third Friday of that month, options that have an expiration, in this case of January, will expire today, that third Friday of January, even though, of course, this is the shortest cycle we can possibly have. The first occurred on a Friday, so then, of course, that means that the third Friday of the month would actually fall on the 15th. Mm-hmm. So this particular expiration is showing some pretty good volatility pop. That is a risk premium that traders assess for buying or selling or protecting, in this case, their holdings in the market. And the reason I think, Andrew, that we're both aware of is that even though Intel came out with great numbers, JP Morgan showing that consumers and businesses might still be a little bit on the edge and missing a little bit on their revenue side and having some cautious comments as well.
Yep.
Couple that with some of the political environment we've got right now, whether you want to look at healthcare and or the tax on these big banks, and you see why we've sort of got a good reason for people to step to the sidelines and why the market was down triple digits on Friday.
Yeah, so I prefer not to think about the political environment because it's getting too complex for anyone to even understand. Now, Senator Dodd, who is going to be stepping down, says that he's going to pretty much trash the financial reform bill that he was working on. Did you see that?
I did.
I mean,
and I'm not surprised, though, because unfortunately, and this is not towards either party in this
right,
regard, but
right.
the problem here is that in order to oversee the risk that these banks are taking on, you need to bring onto some sort of exchange, whether it's electronic or otherwise. I don't want to trade against Goldman Sachs risk, folks.
Right.
So please don't think that that's my purpose.
Right.
But I do want their risk to be visible rather than opaque as it is right now. If banks trade with banks upstairs over the counter, which they do to the tune of trillions of dollars, mm-hmm. and we don't regulate that, then we'll never really know how much risk they're taking on. We will guarantee that we will see repeats of what happened in 2008, 2009, if we don't do that. And unfortunately, there's nothing in Senator Dodd's reform bill that was going to reform that, and that's why I don't even mind that they're trashing this bill, because of just extra regulation doesn't help us if they're not going to give us the clarity or the transparency of clearing those products somewhere where people can assess the risk.
Yeah, and I'll give you my take on this from a political standpoint. Senator Dodd is stepping down, retiring at a pretty good time for his career. He's been very, very kind to the financial institutions over the years. A good friend, we call him. And who knows where his job is going to land him moving forward. He'll probably take some speaking tours and some jobs, but I wouldn't be very surprised if he does, in fact, get a job with a firm, a major firm, We'll see. That's just
We will see. And like you say, he was a good friend of the financial service industry. Mm-hmm. They rewarded him and his campaign handsomely for that. And I think it's one of the reasons, Andrew, we'd probably agree that that he's not going to run again, is that based on reforms that he'd proposed, the industry more or less had told him, don't come to us for the $10 million you need for this campaign.
Right, exactly.
And then, you know, he's a smart enough guy to cut his losses and move on.
Move on. So when we see the markets in this options expiration, do we have to just discount some of the volatility on that day because it is so involved with the options issue and from expiration of particular stock indices, and sometimes we have, you know, quadruple inch witching, and which is expiration, or triple witching. But do we just discount that and kind of say, okay, that day is what it was? Or today was a little bit different, though, because we did see that JP Morgan number. Intel, by the way, sold off also, which was interesting. After hours, they were up about 2%, and then they came in today, they were down about 2%. But the JP numbers top line looked a little bit weak. The bottom line, of course, blew out. It was amazing. Intel blew out. That was amazing. Alcoa this week, I don't even know what happened there. I mean, that was abysmal. I mean, a 6 cent estimate and then a 1 cent hit. Even though they did beat
on
the
revenue. And that was almost all. Yeah, I was going to say, Andrew, that's almost all the input cost, because there is always a price to pay, or always a yin and yang, as you and I know, that goes on with investing. One of those is that if indeed you're going to see a recovery, which we appear to be seeing, mild in some places, strong in others. Mm-hmm. Then we're going to see demand for product like natural gas, like crude oil, increase. And even though we don't really ship natural gas, I know you can liquefy it and ship it, but for the moment, let's say that not very much of it gets shipped. For that reason, when people need natural gas in large quantities, like Alcoa does to make aluminum, and the basic input goes up by 30% in the quarter, it's going to cost you. And that's pretty much what happened, it appears. Their revenue was nearly $1 billion better than everybody expected, but that tail end of the quarter, of the fourth quarter mm-hmm. of 2009, really tagged them on the input side, right. And their costs just overcame the extra money they pulled in from the revenue, and so they missed on the bottom line number.
You know, what my concern has been lately is that there's going to be a time when there's no longer any cutting that is available from the various firms in terms of employees. Been just a tremendous benefit to the bottom line. We know that. Tremendous. And mm-hmm. when they're, you know, Alcoa says in their last conference call, did you hear them say they cut about 75% of their overall labor, and they're not looking to really bring them on. They have a lot of things that they've done to enable them to actually work more efficiently without all that labor, which is an amazing cut, which is an amazing admission. But they said it's a permanent cut. Who knows, you know, what's going to happen a little bit on here or there. But when they're to the point that they can no longer cut expenses, and they have now material costs going up. But even if material costs didn't go up, you know, there's going to be a point, an inflection point, that if they fall back, if it happens at all, they're going to all of a sudden get really squeezed on their overall earnings, don't you think? And that's a concern I have from retail in this inventory restocking cycle.
Yep, I agree with that assessment 100%, Andrew. And I think really there's only so much blood can squeeze from this turnip. Virtually everybody has squeezed it, and that's why we've seen jobs come in so dramatically, and the losses, you know, topped out at nearly 800,000 in a single month.
Right.
And that was because people were having to tighten their belts pretty darn hard. And
right.
As that happened, and as we lost almost an entire industry with the car companies, and financial services, of course, took a big hit too. People being laid off from Goldman Sachs. I mean, when Goldman itself is laying people off.
Right, or Microsoft, and Microsoft too.
Yeah, I mean, you not only have Bear Stearns and Lehman going out, but you have all of their competitors, including, like I say, best of breed, J.P. Morgan, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Credit Suisse, you know, you name it. They were laying people off in that financial service space, or those iBankers, and it was just a miserable time. Well, you can only squeeze so much from that
right.
Extra productivity. And now you really have to get to that Missouri state of mind where it's show me that you've actually got the business and the demand for whatever it is that you do. Some industries are still doing that. I mean, obviously Amazon, Priceline, Apple are examples of companies that are still doing that, still meeting a very strong demand and making a very nice profit doing so. And a lot of their competitors have probably slacked off a little as well. And I don't think any of those three that I named are really places where they were cutting jobs. They were probably adding people.
Exactly.
But unfortunately, not as fast as we need them to add.
Yeah. So let's talk about options, Monta, for a second. You do a lot of different things, I know, but one of your baby, your whole thing is about Options Monster. And I think that people probably, you know, the name doesn't totally describe what you do unless you're, you know, scaring the hell out of people with options, which isn't the case, So tell me a little bit about some of the things that you're doing these days. I know you have some great screening and heat map concept type of technology to help people with options. And I mean, for people that don't do a lot of work with options, obviously that's kind of after people master stocks a lot of times, they get into the area of options. You know, what do you have that can help them, educate them at all?
Absolutely, and thank you, Andrew. Option Monster is a site where we're primarily education and newsletters about investing, and in particular, of course, investing with options.
Right.
We do have a bunch of different sites. We've got Stock Monster and Futures Monster as well, but Option Monster is all about teaching people about options and then showing them where we see unusual activity and then more or less directing them and saying, here's what we would do given the unusual activity we're seeing. We would buy this option, sell that option, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of the publishing side of the business. The other side is the broker, the Trade Monster side, where we built a 4-star rated broker that Barron's rates it at 4 stars. And knock on wood, it's probably the fastest growing deep discount broker on the street. Mm-hmm. And that's a place where people, of course, can trade through. And hopefully one day we'll lure Andrew over there, folks.
Ah,
that's one of our stated goals, by the way.
You never know. So when you get hungry, do you have the Cookie Monster site?
Unfortunately, somebody else registered the Cookie Monster site ahead of me.
So let's talk about the option world. You know, the VIX has come down to, 17 and change, up a little bit in the action today. But the VIX has come down, I think faster than we really, a lot of people expected it to. Where do you see that kind of playing out? And is it even a viable instrument to be really showing us the real volatility and concern? Is there that little concern in the market right now compared to where it was?
There is that little fear in the market as there was a year ago. And I think we all feel a lot better, although I imagine folks who are listening that were pushed out of jobs are not so much feeling good about the way that went, of course.
Yeah.
But from the financial standpoint of whether or not the companies are going to survive, which we were, of course, concerned about last year,
right.
I'm not as concerned about that today. I think most of us would say that for the volatility to come in by 50 or 60%, we're probably feeling 50 or 60% better about how the world is going to be in 2010 than we were at the early part of 2009.
Yeah, I hear you. There's a guy cleaning a window outside, the windows outside of here. I mean, we don't usually do this during the market hours. So the guy kind of cleaning right now. So, you know, usually, but that's great. So again, it is Friday afternoon. It's, what time is it? About 2:30 in the afternoon. One of the things that was a big concern of mine when it came to options was the pricing was out of control when the VIX was up. In other words, you puts and calls, whether you want to do a cover call, straight up buy of a put, call, straddle, strangles, the pricing was out of control. Now, yes, you could find some aberrations in there and try to do some kind of a match trade, of course, and all that. But the fact of the matter is that it was very difficult to get into some of these because the premium on the risk premium part of it, the volatility calculation, was making it almost ridiculous to buy them long, if you will, right? That's come down, so maybe it makes it more a better play these days, do you think?
Absolutely. And in fact, the fact that volatilities have come in, folks, that allows, of course, educated and smart investors like Andrew to be able to do things to protect portfolios, you know, that have given that right over to him. And knock on wood, like I say, that's why I'm always delighted to speak with Andrew, because he has such a large following in the investor community. And Andrew, the folks right now that are nervous, the good news about it is that the protection isn't costing them nearly as much.
Yeah.
I mean, you just said it. The volatility coming in by this much means that if you're nervous about Wells Fargo into next week's earnings cycle or into Morgan Stanley or into U.S. Bank Corp, any of those big three financials, or even Citigroup for that matter, you could buy an option, a put option to protect it, and that option, believe it or not, is probably only a quarter of what it would have been last year.
Yeah.
Because in particular, financial stocks, the volatility is probably in 70 or even 80% from where those stocks were in January of 2009.
Yeah.
So that's good news from an investor standpoint.
Absolutely. So the final thing I want to ask you is and this is something we've talked about this, you and I, before, but it bugs me. It's just one of those kind of things that just gets to me. You know, when you see those incredible moves in options, we saw, I'm trying to remember which company it was. It was a takeover of, I think, was it Dell? Anyways, a technology company. Guy got caught buying enormous amounts of options the day before. There was a leak of information. It's pretty interesting because I know you look at these a lot, that you look for a stock that has an incredible amount of activity on the options for no reason, or no apparent reason, I should say. And oftentimes what we find is that there's something going on behind the scenes. Now, obviously, you know, is there not enough overall regulation on that that's, you know, causing people to basically be able to use inside information? Or is that something that says, okay, listen, you know what, let the regulators do what they're doing. Let us use at least the information that we see from the trend.
Well, and I'm never in favor of the cheaters. I mean, even though part of our business is set up to track people that are cheating, that is reacting to information while it's not public, while, you know, only an insider would really know, just as Andrew's described, I'm not in favor of that, even though we track it. And we routinely do turn our information over to the regulators when they ask us.
Right.
They say, for instance, did you see unusual activity ahead of X, Y, or Z?
Mm-hmm.
And we'll say, yes, we did. Here's what we saw. And then they can go check through the Options Clearing Corp and see where those options cleared.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you still do see a fair amount of that. Obviously, the headlines for this guy, Raj, who was a hedge fund manager,
right,
who was doing that, you know, in millions and millions of shares over his career. Basically, if we're to believe what he's charged with, he made a career out of doing insider trading.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if you see something that walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, or in our case, unusual buying activity on the offer, we're going to follow it. We're not going to have insider information, but like I say, I think more and more, Andrew, these people are getting caught. Raj and his group are just the latest. But they get the little guys and the big guys when they look for this, because the good thing about it is it leaves footprints,
right,
and they do follow those footprints.
So if it leaves footprints and it leaves a kind of a mark, why the heck did nobody ever come down and find out about Bernie Madoff? Because I saw, have you ever seen his statements, by the way? The statements?
Yes, sir.
Great options trades, right? I mean, I'm talking about in fairy tale land.
Yeah, exactly. And I had friends that came to me repeatedly. Unfortunately, I know a guy that lost $50 million with Bernie Madoff.
Yeah, yeah.
And the guy would ask me, John, what do you think? How is he doing this? And I would say, I never said he was a crook because I didn't know that. But I said, I have no idea because it doesn't make sense. You can't do what he's purporting to do in the size and the billions of dollars that he says he's doing it in without impacting the market and without me seeing it.
Right. That was the big issue. I mean, it was no, if you're trading those kind of options on it that never trade throughout the day, how could it possibly be? I can't believe
exactly
all these years that, forget the stocks for a second, because you could do some things beyond and trade out and maybe trade on some quiet markets and all that, possibly, whatever. Who knows? But the options, I never understood how we can get that much play and that much trade going on. It just didn't make any sense.
People wanted to believe, and it's the same thing you always need when you have any kind of fraud. People, whether it's greed or whether it's just that they want to believe that somebody has this magic. I mean, I'm sure if you were to publish the numbers that he's publishing to get people, you'd get a lot more people. You probably couldn't sleep at night, Andrew,
right,
but
right.
You'd get a lot of customers as well. But the problem is, again, if it doesn't seem like the rest of the world can do that, then it's really hard to believe that somebody has this, you know, this Midas touch that he alleged to have, and
yeah,
none of us could justify how he could do it.
I hear you. Well, John Najarian from Options Monster, live at the time on the NASDAQ market site, looking at the options expiration here on Friday. I appreciate it. Everybody needs to go check out Options Monster and the various sites they have under
Please.
There.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
come on over and check out Trade Monster as well as Option Monster.
Plenty of good stuff.
We'd love to have any of Andrew's friends join us.
Yeah, great stuff. Hey, thanks a lot. We'll talk soon. And when you get down to Florida, you know who to look up.
I sure do, Andrew.
I know
you
guys.
Can,
I know you guys party, and I got to get in there. I got to get into the thing. You know what I'm saying?
We would love to go out with you, my friend.
Yeah. All right, we're going to be the party monsters. That's what we're going to be.
I like that one too. We'll try to reserve that.
All right, very good. I'll get my ponytail
going.
All right, talk to you soon. Bye bye.
Bye bye, Andrew.
John Najarian, what a character. Great guy, and hopefully I'll be able to party with him one day. But right now, we're going to plug in. We're going to kind of bring it forward, and we're going to go to a discussion with a very, very good friend of mine, John Markman, who recently put out a just amazing, amazing book, which is, you all know the original book, The Reminiscence of a Stock Operator, you know, the story of Jesse Livermore and all, and we'll talk about that. But this is the details, and this is a version of the book with commentary and insights on the life and times of Jesse Livermore. And John, you with me?
I'm here.
Hey, buddy, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
I am great, and I got to tell you something. I'm gonna embarrass you for a moment. This is fabulous. This book is just. I got to tell you something. Most traders, most people who live in the world of investing, have read or listened to the Reminiscence of a Stock Operator once, twice, three times, five times. Over and over, because you get insight and you get some of the subtleties when you listen to it over and over. Right? You know that, but. You went one step further. You looked into this and really went to find just more than just the details to describe a lot of the players, a lot of the insights, the internals, some of the backstories of that book. And wow, that it must have taken you a long time to gather that information. It's really amazing.
Well, thank you very much. I'm among those who had read Reminiscences of a Stock Operator. When I first started out as a trader, it was recommended to me. And I read it again and again afterwards, and I began to think, who are these people that he mentions? Are they real people, or are they fictional? And it turns out that about 90% of the people that he mentions in the book are real. About 10% of them are either pseudonyms or completely made up. And so I decided I really wanted to find out, who these people were, what was interesting about them, why did they come up to the top of his consciousness, why did they populate his book?
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I started to dig into them, I realized that the reader in 1923, when the book first came out, really knew who these characters were.
Yeah.
And each time he mentioned someone like James Keane or E.W. or a Harriman or a Baruch, Bernard Baruch, excuse me, I have a cold, it would resonate with the people in 1923, but the people today don't know who these people are. And so the book, as rich as it is in psychological insights, people today don't understand it the way that it was intended in 1923.
So let's back up for a second. For those people who haven't read Reminiscence of a Stock Operator, either the book or it's on audible.com, you can grab it there. Tell them a little bit about the story of Jesse Livermore and, how is it possible that a story from the 1920s and 30s can be really that much of an encouraging, motivating, and insightful piece for today's markets?
That's a great question. Okay, Reminiscences of a Stock Operator is a historical novel based on the life of Jesse Livermore. Jesse Livermore was the most famous trader of commodities and stocks from around 1900 to 1935. In fact, the 1929 newspapers, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, blamed the crash on Jesse Livermore because he was known as such a fantastic and influential short seller. The book is a collaboration between the greatest financial journalist of that time, Edwin Lefevre, and this trader, Livermore. And what was amazing about Livermore was that he was, although he was very a terrific trader, and had really come up from absolutely nothing, absolute poverty. And he was had made what was at the time the equivalent of billions of dollars in the market. He was not very well known to the public because he played what he called a lone hand. He didn't want to be in the newspapers, didn't schmooze it up with newspaper reporters like other traders did. So when Lefevre, who was, I would say, the equivalent of a Michael Lewis today,
mm-hmm.
when he chose Livermore on which to hang his novel, it was a very radical and unusual decision. Although he was, as I say, although Livermore was famous, no one really knew much about him. And so you really have this amazing pairing of a genius of a reporter and a genius of a trader. And together they made a book that has stood the test of time, not because of great insights into actual trading techniques, but because of the deep psychological insights on the life of a trader. In fact, I'd say there's more failure in the book than there is success.
There's
a little more.
So,
and it's how the trader deals with setback after setback after setback, and how he grows as a trader from a trader to a from a gambler, basically, to a trader, to a speculator, and finally to an investor. That really captures the imagination of investors today.
Yeah, I mean, he refers to himself, well, clearly a stock operator, but as a speculator, more so than an investor or even a trader. That's more of the modern day politically correct way of discussing the, you know, if you're a speculator or not, because speculation has this kind of bad connotation. But in the book, what's interesting also is that, you know, he I agree with you, he goes through this whole, you know, starting out with the bucket shops. As a matter of fact, you know what, I have the book, I want to ask you something, because you know, we hear about these bucket shops, and we get the cursory, you know, kind of image of what a bucket shop is—a sleazy kind of place, almost like an off-track betting. That's how I envision it in my head. Can you imagine that?
Yeah, pretty much so.
Right, with tickets everywhere, with people kind of excited, some people upset, the usual players that are hanging out watching the tape and all that. But
what's interesting about those bucket shops too, Andrew, is that although we see them today as sort of an off-track betting type of an operation, in which they were. They were strictly gambling on whether stocks would go up or down. There was no actual investment in a company. They dressed them up at the time to look like brokerages. So the average investor, the average guy in Boston, and very often a lot of these bucket shops were in the Midwest where people were more gullible at that time, they thought they were actually investing in companies, and in fact they were just gambling on whether prices were going to go up and down. And the bucket shops were in cahoots with specialists and market makers on the street. And so when people in a bucket shop had too many bets, let's say, on something going up, the bucket shop would communicate with the broker to, you know, drop the price of a stock, you know, precipitously to take out all the stops.
Right.
So they were not just gambling dens. They were actually, most of them were actually fraudulent.
Right. So here's what happens. I want to kind of give my listeners a little bit of an insight of what I'm looking at. So this is a hard-covered book, and it's on page 56, by the way. And it, as an example, so it talks about, of course, on the curb and on other exchanges in the country or in Europe, they deal in wheat, cotton, provisions, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what happens is what John's done very smartly, put a little notation there with a number, 4.3, and on the left side is the annotation, talks about the New York Curb Exchange, and talks about the history about, you know, what was the curb and what, you know, how did it develop, and some of the more interesting factoids, if you will, about the curb dating back to when it did, as an example, talking about the electronic car coupler company back in 1899, et cetera. And then I kind of flipped through, I kind of dog-eared a bunch of stuff here, kind of flipping through to give everybody an example. And here's what I really thought was neat. Page 170, we're talking about 11.6. So now 11.6 is this whole discussion that says, from the book, I can remember hearing a story about Addison Comack that illustrates very nicely what I wish to point out. From all I've heard, I'm inclined to think that Comack was one of the ablest stock traders the street ever saw. So the pullout here is a nice picture, which I don't know where you got these from. That's amazing. And a whole discussion of who he was. He was a great Wall Street bear in the Civil War era, and he would team up with Jay Gould and James Keene, and he was close to William Travers, whom he shared his offices on 23rd Street in Manhattan, blah, blah, blah. All about this, about the people and the players in this. And I think that is really cool. One more was on page 326. It talks about, in the book, it talks about a lot of times that Livermore would go after a particular company, whether it was the railroads, whether it was or cotton or whatever it may have been. He made big bet, I mean big and almost make or break bets on these deals. And in the book, it talks about his original book. It talked about the Piggly Wiggly, and it talked about there was a whole story about that. And then you do a pullout of actually, which is unbelievable, one of the shelves from 1917 of the Piggly Wiggly, and you talk about the backstory about that Piggly Wiggly was a Tennessee-based supermarket chain and founded in 1923, and this whole discussion about this whole deal that went on, the backstory, just an amazing amount of information to fill people in, and there's so many people that love this story / history. So anyway, just to give everybody an insight of that, how did you go about getting this information?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned Addison Comack, somebody I didn't know either. And you know, as I said, when I would read the book, I would say, you would see someone like you would see a name like Addison Comack, And you're like, I don't know who Adam Kamik is. Right. And you, because the story is intriguing enough, you just kind of keep going. But I wanted to find out who Adam Kamik was. So I Googled him and, of course, came up with nothing. And then I looked through some of the books I had from the library, didn't find him. And then I discovered, we discovered about a quarter of the way through our research, that Google has digitized, you know, tens of thousands of books that have been sitting on university library shelves for, you know, for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of, it turns out that a lot of the traders of the 19th century wrote autobiographies. It was sort of a thing that people liked to do. And in their autobiographies, they would talk about people they traded with. And we found a book that had a biography of Addison Kamik. We also found, and you know, we found a lot of details of his life, which were really quite fascinating. I'll tell you one other thing. The New York Times has put online its entire archive from 1861.
Wow.
And it is, and you know what, and every single word since 1861 is searchable. So you can type in something like Addison Kamik dies. And then you find the obituary of Addison Kamik from, let's say, you know, 1897. And the New York Times was an amazing resource. I mean, they covered Wall Street in an unbelievably detailed way. I mean, they covered it, you know, there were the day was longer back then. They covered it, and there was also Saturday sessions. They covered it in unbelievable detail, and they loved to cover the characters like Addison Kamik. And so it's pretty easy to sort of hopscotch through the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and Time Magazine archives and find some of these lost stories. Wow. And what's interesting also, when you start to go through and look at what these guys did back in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, they traded very, very much just like we did today. They faced all the same, you know, problems of fear and greed and envy and regret that we face today. And I was just looking at the passage about Kamik that you mentioned, and here's a comment that someone could have made today. This is, he sold his exchange seat in 1897 and retired. His fortune was estimated to be about $1 million at the time, which would be about $10 million today. And when asked for the keys to his success, Kamik would answer, "Luck, sir, chiefly luck. Perhaps caution, too. I never overtrade and don't like big losses. I don't think I ever took a big loss in my life."
Good words. Good words. Yep.
Look, that's an epigram you could think about today.
Right. It's you know, one of the things about the book that I remember when we talk about the original book was there was some commentary. I think you mentioned this in the beginning. Was, you know, how true is this? You know, how much truth and how much of a story is it? How much excess embedded fluff? Because you talked about a lot of the names were changed and all that. I mean, you've heard that before.
I would say that to use the Colbert term, I would say there's a lot of truthiness here.
Uh-huh.
It's about, I would say, 90% true. And, you know, part of my job was to figure out which was the 10% that wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that this collaboration between Lefevre and Livermore is part of what is sort of produces a result that is not, we're not exactly sure what's true and what's not. We're not exactly sure at all times. When the main protagonist, Larry Livingston, is talking, is that really Livermore talking, or is it Lefevre putting words in his mouth? And there have been people, there have been reviewers in the past who have said, "Well, Lefevre didn't really have much of a role in this book. This is really a Livermore autobiography, and Lefevre was just there to sort of, you know, dot the I's and cross the T's." And this turned out to be completely untrue because. Mm-hmm. Due to the digitizing that Google did, we were able to look at all of the articles that Lefevre wrote in the early 1900s, 1910s, 1920s. And there are a lot of passages from his writing in magazines like Everybody's Magazine and Muncie Magazine and the Saturday Evening Post that are virtually lifted out of those magazine articles and put into this book.
Wow. So
I would also point out that one of the main themes of reminiscences is market manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
Manipulation is something that Lefevre, the author, was fascinated by. And unlike a lot of journalists at the time who were focused mostly on, you know, promoting stocks and writing about the great figures of the time, Lefevre was really focused on explaining to the public how they were constantly being manipulated by larger forces. And I really sincerely doubt that this was something that was on Livermore's mind a lot. So I really think, I believe that the last, particularly the last 10 chapters, which are a lot about manipulation, are almost strictly Lefevre speaking through the Livermore.
Like the experience.
Exactly.
Yeah. So great read. I'm going to put a link to this. I'm assuming it's on Amazon and et cetera. This is Reminiscence of a Stock Operator with new commentary and insights on the life and times of Jesse Livermore. Annotated edition by John Markman, forward by Paul Tudor Jones. Wow, very impressive. Lots of great things from William O'Neill, Roger Lowenstein, Ken Fisher, et cetera, et cetera. Great stuff. I would pick it up. This is a great piece to not put on the living room table, per se, but to read. And I think that great insights about the market. Speaking of which, you know, you and I talk rather regularly, and we're always kind of bantering back and forth. You've been rather bullish since, a number of months ago, and talking about the liquidity-driven rally and the fact that a lot of the things we talk about is the credit-driven bull market has preceded the stock market. A lot of people are very, very bullish on credit fixed income and disbelieving the stock market, but yet the stock market continued to rise. And that's been an ongoing theme for some time. You and I have kind of talked about that. Tell me what you're seeing these days, kind of your outlook and your kind of insights into that.
Sure. I would say one of the main themes of reminiscences, just to step on that, go back to that for one second, mm-hmm. is if I could put it into three or four words, one of his main themes is don't be a sucker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't be a sucker.
Right.
The market is always trying to fool you in certain ways so that they can take your money. So it's our job as a trader, and my job as a journalist as well, is to figure out who is trying to manipulate the tape and why.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was very bearish all the way through, as you know, 2007, 2008, into 2009. I finally figured out that in about April 2009, last year, that the tape had really been manipulated to a large extent to push it down so that the large brokerages, hedge funds, et cetera, could buy stocks cheaply.
Hmm.
You know, people think of the stock market always being manipulated up. But as you can see, as you learn in reminiscences, it was a practice certainly in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s by Jay Gould to manipulate the market down so he could buy stuff cheaply. That's how he bought Western Union.
That worked.
It does work. And it worked for Goldman. And you look at these companies paying bonuses today, and it's clear that they made a fortune off of the decline.
Right.
Right?
Right.
They're the only companies in America that are reporting gigantic profits. Why is that?
Yeah, it is a little strange.
So, it is. So in around April of last year, I figured this out, and I was bullish, as you know, all the way through last year.
Mm-hmm.
And up until, I would say the first or second week of this year. And now I think what's going to happen is that you'll have maybe like a 8 to 10 month timeout.
So that's kind of like a peak, a plateau here.
Yeah, I'm not bearish per se. Mm-hmm. Although I think the market has a pretty good, you know, there's a lot of risk of the market, you know, going down as much as let's say 10% from the highs that we saw last week.
Which isn't, by the way, a lot considering what we're dealing with here. I mean, 10% used to be this, you know, horrible number. You know, even 20%. I know that's terrible. Don't get me wrong, but 20% doesn't even seem like a disastrous point at this time.
Right. I mean, I think the point is that when I look back through history and I do a lot of research on exactly how the market has behaved at various points in history, you can see that almost every time that there's been a really large run-up, such as the one we just saw, where you have the move of like 70% off of an absolute low,
mm-hmm.
It's not uncommon at all to get a 60 to 80% run-up. But after that period, the stock market, let's say the S&P 500, becomes very extended, very high above its trailing 10-month average, let's
mm-hmm,
say,
30-day mm-hmm.
average or 10-month average. And if you look throughout the entire history of the market, the 10-month average usually only lags behind the index by about anywhere between 3% to 5%. Well, right now it's lagging by 12%. Mm. And anytime you get a double-digit percentage increase over that trailing 10-month average for 7 or 8 months in a row, which we have just done, you get a pause.
Right.
And that pause can be anywhere from, in some cases, 8 months as it was in 8 to 10 months as it was in 2004, or as long as 18 months as it was in 83, 84.
Right after that, yeah.
Everyone remembers that the market surged in August 1982, and went to a big peak in 1983. But what they forget is that then you had this long 18-month pause while the trailing average caught up with the index. And I think that's probably what we're going to have again. We'll just have this kind of timeout and let the average catch up. That's the technical talk. The more fundamental talk would be that we want to let earnings companies grow into the higher PEs that they've been afforded over the last several months of rally.
This would play very well into my inventory. Go ahead.
It's not a big deal. I mean, what will happen is very much for those of your listeners who remember 2004, you know, 2004 ended up to be a plus year, I think, by double digits, low double digits, maybe 12%. But the first 10 months of 2004 were just a grind.
Yeah.
And the market would just, you know, go down, and, you know, it would just kind of, just as it was gathering steam to the downside, there'd be a sharp reversal that would wipe out the shorts.
Right.
And then you come back up and not quite make a new high and go back down and then repeat and repeat and repeat until you got to October when the average, trailing average finally caught up with the index and it was time to get back to the races. And then you had a very nice market for the next 2 or 3 years. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if we have this like a 10-month timeout with the downward bias. And then once you get to around October or November of this year, Then you get back to the rally, and that rally lasts another, you know, maybe 2 or 3 years. You go back to the highs that we saw in 2007.
That's interesting from a couple of points. First, I think like a Tom DeMarc would call this, not technically by his words, but an exhaustion phase. You know, you get to be a point of just, you know, there's just how much more money can be pushed in, how much more risk are people willing to take at these levels. And when you look at volume issues, you know, the volume on the buys have been very low and the volumes on the sells have been very high. This is consistent with what's going on. And I think that this exhaustion phase could be kicking in here because it is getting long in the tooth for a rally that has seen, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5% monthly returns. That's ridiculous. I mean, I'm not suggesting that this can't go on or it's going to reverse. I'm just saying, generally speaking, that kind of rally doesn't go on forever. That may come up from, I agree with you, from a trough. To a peak point, but then now what you have on the back end is always the people who are you know, the last people that are throwing your money in usually do what we call blow off tops, right? You know, they get that kind of blow off top point where they've just, you know, said, okay, they've given in, capitulation, they're done. Gets to a point, whether it's a technical point or whether it's just a point that they just have totally surrendered to the fact that, okay, let me put some money in this market now. You know, to start doing that. But, you know, this also plays in, I think I sent you my piece recently on our economic outlook for the next quarter. And mm-hmm. It plays into the whole inventory restocking cycle. We saw inventories come out last week and they grew nicely, right? And I always ask, is that a good thing or a bad thing? You know, is inventory growth mean that there are new orders coming in and the manufacturers, if you will, are producing more, therefore they're, you know, because they're getting orders, or is it because there's less retail orders or less orders coming in and therefore they're sitting on a lot more inventory? It's kind of an interesting conundrum.
Yeah, it is a really good question. And I think that we'll know more in the fullness of the time. You know, I think the economy is actually in decent shape. I think that we'll have positive GDP growth this year. You know, it could be 2.5 to 4%. And that's supportive of a strong market. You know, the greatest stock market, the greatest year that we've seen in our lifetimes was 1999. And that was supported by GDP growth of a grand total of 4%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't need great economic growth. You just need some. So I think that you know, the growth that we're going to see this year is supportive of a decent market, and I think that there will be successful sectors. By the way, this is going to be more like a 1970s type of market where you have, in the 1970s the market went nowhere, but it went in nowhere in big waves. You know, you had market would go way up to like Dow 1000 and then back down, and then back up and then back down. And all that time, what people were doing was scrambling to figure out what are the hot sectors, what are the hot sectors. And throughout the 1970s, the hot sector was mostly energy. And I don't know whether energy will be the hot sector this year or not. Right now, it's looking to me as if materials may be the strong sector, and we're going to keep an eye on that.
Yeah, and that was also, of course, the energy crisis back then we had, don't forget, back in the 70s. I mean, that was kind of a spooky time.
And we'll face a similar crisis, although, you know, if there's lower economic growth, people use less energy. And already, it's amazing, from an ecological point of view, people really are using less gasoline than they did two or three years ago.
Mm-hmm. In the spirit of full disclosure, we went short on oil a week and a half ago, actually, and that's paying off nicely. But, you know, every time we've seen this kind of move above the 80s, 82, it's been popping back pretty nicely. So I think we have close to, last week, oil was down about 6%, and we used the double inverse on that one.
Yeah, I mean, oil trades very technically. It's also, you know, the most manipulated market in the world, and it's also a very thin market, so it can be pushed around. The large investors, the large institutions whim a lot more than people imagine. But, you know, if you look at the actual sectors and look at actual stocks right now, it's quite remarkable that a lot of the former leaders are really starting pretty serious downtrends. The banks, for instance, they peaked in October, November. And they've been making lower highs and lower lows ever since.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look at Google, made a high in December, and it's been making lower. Actually, it's been going straight down, to say the truth. It hasn't even made lower highs.
Right.
If you look at something like, some of the energy names also starting to make lower highs and lower lows. And this is how, you know, negative phases begin. But on the other hand, if you look at the material stocks, they are not making lower highs. They're making new highs. So that's indicative of me that investors are keeping those bets on. And when I say materials, I'm talking about steel, coal, chemicals.
Right, like cement that. And things of that nature. So, you know, so how
do you... Matter of fact,
I'll
just remind people that in 2007,
mm-hmm.
2008, that was only two years ago, the market, you remember, really the broad market was down about 20% by June. That was the year of the bear. That was the period of the Bear Stearns collapse, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had to be rescued. But steel and energy stocks were up 20% by the middle of 2007. So if you were in the right sector, energy and metals, you were doing fine through the middle of 2007, even though the market was down. And I think we're going to have a similar period now. Well, you're just going to have to be in the right sectors.
Well, so two things you're talking about, sector rotation issues and stock picking, which is actually how you manage portfolios and how you manage it for your clients and for your newsletter, which, by the way, Strategic Advantage is available. We'll put a link on that also for John because he writes, boy, but this guy, you get into details that are just terrific, by the way. Avid reader of your work, and the good news is I get to get it from the horse's mouth, pick up the phone and call you and speak and talk about things, so it's great. But, you know, materials and energy and somewhat financials are really the pet sectors for the hedge funds and the big boys. And that's some of the other reason why there's some strength there. A lot of times you'll look at that and you'll wonder why. And because that is really the play that many of the hedge funds use a lot of times, and because oil is easily moved around, et cetera, well, that then translates to a lot of profits for the energy companies oftentimes. So the whole thing works in a big cycle, and I think that's part of the reason. But what do you do?
Well, one of the things that we're seeing the hedge funds do today is they're taking large bets, large individual bets on special situations.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed the Wall Street Journal this morning had an article that said that William Ackman at Pershing Square had made his largest bet right now, his largest position, is in Kraft.
Yeah, $969 million, about 2% of the total company. He's kind of riding the coattails of Buffett on this one.
Well, sort of. I mean, Buffett does have a big stake in the company. But the thing is, what I want people to understand is that this is not a materials play. You know, it's not a broad economy player or anything of that nature. It's a special situation. He thinks a certain stock is going to go up for a certain reason.
Right. He did that with Target, although later abandoned it.
Right. And so, but this is the way that a lot of funds are making a lot more money. They're going to be increasingly making big bets on special situations like that. And that's also indicative of a market that may be going nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
In the broad sense, where all individual names are more successful.
So how do you play this? How would you set up a portfolio, not aside from individual stock picking for a moment, how do you set up a broad-based portfolio to benefit or to not get hurt in this environment?
Well, I think you're going to start to have to back away a little bit from having a large part of your portfolio in the big index funds, which really worked great last year.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have to sit back and really recognize, you know, not be too quick about it, but really start to look here if the market does go sideways as to which groups are beginning to outperform. And then we want to move our money into those.
Right.
Okay? And it's going to seem like momentum investing, which in a way it is. But the thing is that where people kind of get messed up is they say, well, this group is going up, so there's a problem with that. And I should be in stocks, and I should be in groups that are sort of going sideways because they're a better value. Well, that's not a strategy that's going to work in a sideways market.
Right.
You do have to move the money into the groups that are working.
Yeah, follow the trend.
And although, pardon me?
Follow the trend, don't fight the tape.
Right. And then the other thing that will work in a situation like this is special situations. You know, in my letter and in my funds, we have two special situations that we like a lot. One of them is a company called Cytori Therapeutics, symbol CYTX. I don't normally like biotech or medical device stocks, but I made an exception in this case. They have a unique way of helping plastic surgeons and cardiac surgeons extract what they call stem cells from fat tissue and use that and manipulate it in a certain way to strengthen either the cardiac walls after a heart attack in the case of cardiac patients and to create a very successful grafts for breast reconstructive surgery as well as for facial reconstructive surgery.
Hmm.
So this is a company I think is very undervalued and should do very well this year. And if I'm right, you know, that's a special situation that will work out well for my clients. And another stock I like a lot as a special situation is a company called Quantum, symbol QTM. And people remember it as a hard drive maker back in the 80s and 90s.
Oh, sure. I remember that.
But it's a very, very cheap stock. I think the PE on forward earnings is about 5, where most of its peers are in the 15 to 20 area. And it has its main product right now is a deduplication software that's used by large companies to reduce their data storage requirements. And it competes against Data Domain, which was bought by EMC in the end of last year at a PE of over 35. Now, that was bought out at a PE of 35. We think that Quantum actually has a better product and is selling better than Data Domain's, and the PE is 5.
And obviously the need to reduce data is ever present. I can tell you that personally.
And we think they had a great quarter, and we think the stock will go up when it reports in the fourth week of January.
Wow, interesting.
So I think those are my two favorite special situations right now. Full disclosure, I own them and my clients own them.
Oh, good. Okay. All right, we're going to wrap it up, but that's awesome. I think that between the book that you have out and your writings and all that, you're always a constant inspiration, I must say, and then also your insight into the markets. We'll see how that plays out. Because I know you go short, when do you think it's time, or what will be the signal? That's a better discussion. What will be the signal for you that it's time to go short? Because we know all the long discussion here, but if things turn, are you going to do that or just pare down the portfolio?
I'm not short anything right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I am on the lookout, and we'll know it when we'll know the right time when we see it. I mean, I'll announce it, you know, in the newsletter and also in my journalism.
Okay.
One time, I think that a neutral sideways market is a pretty tough market to be short in, except
right.
for short periods of time.
Right.
Because just when the technicals flip over, and it looks like it's the right time to be short, you're gonna see the buyers come in, and wrench the market around and push it back up.
Right.
And so those kinds of periods are very difficult to be short.
Yeah,
it's very tempting, but at the same time, it can be tough. So again, it's going to be special situations. You know, you look at some of these retailers, like the Gap. You know, like the Gap is in an established downtrend. You know, if you want a short Gap, you know, you can probably do that right now. I'm not, but I'm saying that you would look for stocks in sectors that are established downtrends, and I think that a lot of the apparel retailers. Are entering, you know, that category.
Yeah, I'll mention something to you just to describe this, what he's saying exactly to the point. So we went short. We've done this several times. We went short Wynn a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, something like that. And we've been very successful with our shorting of Wynn. And we found a price that we felt that it was going to be at a point where it was breaking down. And we entered a small short position in Wynn. 3 days later, it turns on a dime. And moves up by about 8% after some, you know, upgrade that came out of nowhere, almost a rescue upgrade, we're calling them right now. And, you know, all the profit we made with 8 or 9% profit in about a week and a half, and exactly the point where it should have broken down under normal circumstances. You're right. The buyers came in and just sucked it all up and moved it right back up. And then we moved out of it for no gain, no loss, or I think maybe.
You know, one of the reasons for that, you know, the reason that the that this can happen is that underlying everything else that we're talking about, there you mentioned the credit bull market, and there really is a strong credit bull market right now, and probably the strongest that people have seen in 25 or 30 years. And what's important about a credit bull market is that individual companies are able to sell corporate bonds, at very low spreads versus treasuries. In other words, when it's difficult to sell bonds like it was last year at this time, even if you're a large company like General Electric or General Motors, if you're a large company like Kraft, you might have to sell, when you wanted to go out and sell bonds, you would have to sell them, if treasuries were at, let's say, 5%, you would have to sell your bonds at 10% in order to, a 10% yield, an annual yield, in order to attract buyers.
Right.
Well, the credit bull market is so strong right now that it's easy to sell, rather than selling at gigantic spreads like last year, they're selling at very small spreads. So if treasuries are at like 5%, then you can sell your bonds at 6%.
Mm-hmm.
And companies are doing that in droves, which is why there is a credit bull market. And what's important about that is that for about the first year and a half of a credit bull cycle, companies use the proceeds from those bond sales to repair their balance sheets. They pay off higher priced debt, right? They retire higher priced bonds, and they shore up their balance sheets in other ways. But after the balance sheets have been repaired, Andrew, they start using that money for shareholder enhancement purposes, which is another way of saying stock buybacks,
right?
And mergers.
Mm-hmm.
So if companies able to have access to a lot of money and through bond sales, what they can do when their stocks start to deteriorate is simply apply that money from their treasury and start buying back the stock.
Right.
And that provides sort of an undertone that's very difficult for short sellers.
Right. And just look what Microsoft did. I mean, Microsoft picked up another $40 billion in a bond sale last year just out of nowhere, the first time they ever did so in the history of the company. Now they have just a giant, on top of the fact they had a giant treasure chest of money that they had to begin with, and then they have another $40 billion sitting in cash.
And they will deploy that in shareholder enhancement purposes.
Right.
They will buy back shares, and when they buy back shares, it automatically enhances the value of the stock because you're spreading your earnings across fewer shares.
Right, exactly.
And it's a very difficult environment for short sellers.
I hear you.
I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just saying it's a lot more difficult than it was in 2017.
And back to the point is you have to be more of a sector, involved in sectors, or you have to be picking individual situations, as you mentioned. So I think that's the sum up for that. So check it out. We're going to mention it one more time that you need to go and get John D. Markman, J-O-N, by the way, if you look it up, Reminiscence of a Stock Operator, with a commentary and insights on the life and times of Jesse Livermore. Of course, pick up his Strategic Advantage letter as well. John, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. And that's going to wrap up episode number 144 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Don't forget that episode 150, we're going to have that special call-in show. So if you're interested, we're going to put some information on the show notes of this episode. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com right now. And everybody that participates in that show is going to get a free copy of my book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. So make sure you do that. That's going to be limited, of course, to any of the people we use on the show. And if you want to kind of enter a discussion about your portfolio, about stocks, about the markets, about the economy, and be on that show, episode number 150, check it out there, and we'll submit it. We'll hook up with a conversation, and we'll go from there. Thanks for joining me. Have a great week. Be profitable. Be safe. Be on the lookout for great opportunities. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.